Hey everybody, this is the Drive On Podcast, where we talk about issues affecting veterans after they get out of the military. I'm your host, Scott DeLuzio, and now, let's get on with the show. This is part two of a two-part episode with Wes Black. Part one came out last week, and if you haven't listened to that episode yet, go ahead and give it a listen too. In that episode, we talked a bit about Wes's military career and some medical issues that he had stemming from his service. Our conversation lasted for well over 2 hours, and I didn't want to cut out anything from our conversation, so I decided to break it out into two parts. And so in this episode, we're going to talk about my brother Steven and tell some funny stories and also some serious stories about combat and the circumstances surrounding his death and other things that went on during his life. So without further delay, let's get on with the second part of this episode. We talked a little bit about, you know, how you guys met at Norwich. Were you, because you said you already had been in the Guard, you already went to basic training at the point where you met him.
Yep.
Were you one of the guys who kind of talked him into joining the Guard? Or
So I was not. I was not one of the guys that talked Steve into joining. Steve, the first time I met Steve was actually at a drill weekend, and it was Halloween weekend. And it was like a mutafor, so it was a Saturday, Sunday, non-remain overnight. And so Saturday night, we got cut loose. And so, you know, all the guys had, because I had been in the unit for a little over a year, like I knew to bring civilian clothes to the drill, because if we got released, like we could go out into Burlington and raise hell. And so it's Halloween night, right? And so Steve kind of looks at me and he's like, bro, I don't have any clothes. Like, I don't have any civilian clothes. Because at the time, he was a freshman at Norwich. So freshmen aren't allowed, according to the Rook policy, you're not allowed to have civilian clothes. You could if you were in the Guard, but Steve had only recently just come to drill and didn't know the rules. And so I was like, fuck it, man. It's Halloween. Like, just tell everybody you're a soldier. At the time, it was 2004. And I was like, just tell everybody you're a fucking soldier. Everybody loves fucking soldiers. I mean, we're fucking heroes, man. Just fucking go as a soldier. So he kind of, so he's like, all right. So we go downtown, right? And I'm in like civilian clothes. I think I had stopped and grabbed like a stupid mask or something at like one of the Halloween party stores. And so we're downtown in Burlington. Eating pizza and drinking beer at what was it, Manhattan Pizza or Mr. Mike's or something, like one of the pizza shops. And I had actually scratched my ID, the back of my military ID, because I was born in 1985. I had scratched it so where the 5 connects down to the bottom, I scratched away that side, and then on the other side I scratched it so it looked like a 3, and then used the Sharpie to color it in, like a fine point Sharpie. So I actually had an ID that said I was like 2 or 3 years older than I really was, and I was 19, so it said I was 21. So I would be able to get into all these clubs and drink, and I could go up to the bar and get drinks. In case the police are listening, I only did it once. Anyway, we're out, we're drinking, and I had set Steve up in the corner, and I was like, hey, listen, I'm going to go out to the bar. I'm going to get us a couple of drinks. I'm going to get us some food. And so at the time, I think he was with Lisa. And so I come back, and Steve was always a charmer. Like, he could strike up a conversation with the fucking wall. And I mean, he really could. So I come back, and there's these 3 women standing around the table that Steve is at. And I'm like, motherfucker. I was like, yeah, this is going to be a good night. So I sit down, and I was like, hey, what's going on? So we're sitting there chatting. And I look at Steve, and I'm like, yo, man, you going to bring these girls home? And he looks at me, and he's like, nope, I got a girlfriend. And I'm like, what? So sure enough, man, we went back to the fucking hotel room, and I'm sitting there going, are you fucking kidding me? And sure enough, he called Lisa. Hey, how's it going, honey? I was like, oh my God. So I rode his ass a little bit about that. And so to give you the other side of Steve is after we had come back from Iraq, and so I came back from Iraq. I tried to go back to Norwich, and I just couldn't do it. So, I bummed around the Vermont Guard for a long time. And so when we were getting ready to train up to go to Afghanistan, Steve and I were in the same platoon. We were both team leaders, so we were both sergeants. I think he was assigned to first squad or maybe second squad, and I was third squad. So I was a third squad alpha team leader. I think he was like the first squad Bravo team leader or first or second squad Bravo team leader. And so we were out one day at Fort Polk getting ready to train our guys. We'd set up a glass house, which is just tape on the dirt in the shape of a house. And we were going to do these close quarter battle drills and like train our guys on how to move through houses. And so we go walking out and I don't know what it was. I turned to Steve and I went to check him, right? Because Steve was a hockey player. He was a phenomenal hockey player. And he happened to get just low enough on me that when he and I went to check each other, he actually popped my right shoulder out, like dislocated it. And I was like, all of a sudden I'm like, oh fuck. And it, like my shoulder's killing me. And of course Steve feels bad instantly. He is like, oh my God, bro. Like, I'm so sorry. And so he gets me over to the aid station, like helps basically like carry my arm. And we get over to the aid station. The doc puts it back in. The doc's like, all right, listen, like, you got to take it easy over the next day or two. Like, just ice it, relax it. I'm going to give you like some compression bandage to put over it. I really want you to take it easy. So I'm like, okay. So we go back out. We do the training. We go back inside to sit down. And we had these big open, basically barracks with all these little cots, right? And so I'm sitting on my cot. Mm-hmm. And Eric Kilburn, who was one of the guys, he was in second platoon. Very funny guy. Loved to, you know, just joke around with anybody. And Steve was the kind of person where he would make fun of anyone mercilessly, right? If he knew how to, if he knew how to push your buttons, that's exactly what he would do. But
yeah, the slightest opening,
he would expose me. Oh yeah, and he would dig. Yeah. But I will tell you what. Only Steve was allowed to do it, because if somebody else started doing it, Steve was the first person to be like, yo, motherfucker, shut the fuck. Like, he was very adamant that like he was the only one that could fucking needle you. And so I'm sitting on my cot, minding my own business. I think I actually had my headphones on. I wasn't paying attention. I was watching a movie. Well, Killy comes up with his pillow, right? And he just whacks me across the back. Just, he's trying to be funny. Like, he's trying to start a pillow fight. Except it pops my shoulder back out, because I had literally had it just put back in. And so, of course, I instantly buckle. I start crying because of the pain. Like, it fucking hurt, man. And so Killy kind of looks at me. He's like, yo, you all right, bro? And, like, I pull my headphones on. I'm like, motherfucker. So Steve comes flying over, like, literally puts his hands on Kilburn. He's like, yo, motherfucker, what's your fucking problem? And so Killy's like, whoa, I'm sorry, I had no idea. And I'm like, it's okay, man, like, don't worry about it. So Steve actually helps me get my shoulder pop back into place, because he watched the doctor do it, so Steve knows how to do it. So Steve helps me pop back into place, right? It feels better. So he sits down next to me, and I have, like, tears rolling down my face from the pain. It hurts so bad. And he looks at me, and he goes, you all right? And I was like, yeah, bro, it just fucking hurts, man. He goes, all right. And he kind of slaps me on the knee, and he goes, good. Get yourself fixed up, because you look like you just took second place in a drag race. And fucking stands up and walks away. I was like, you motherfucker. Like, but that was the kind of person that Steve was. Like, he would make sure you were okay, but he would make sure that he got one in as he was walking away.
Right.
And so,
yeah, the last day that I was at Camp Atterbury, you guys were there. And we, after we left the Atterbury, we went down to Fort Polk. And so we had all of our shit, you know, packed up, you know, ready to go and everything. And we only had like so much space on the buses that took us down there. And so, like, if you had extra stuff that was not, issued or, you know, on the packing list or whatever, like, you had to carry it. Yep. Like, it wasn't going in the other bags. Like, there just was no room for it. And so, while we were waiting for the buses to get loaded up and everything, like, we had a few minutes before the buses left. And so we were able to come grab some chow. It was like not at our designated time or whatever, but, I walked in and Steve was in there. So like it was like your unit's time to be in there. And I walked in and I managed to, I actually ate dinner, that night with him and, a few of the other guys that you guys were with. I don't know specifically who at the time, was there, but so I come in and my salt pack has like shit hanging off of it. Like I look like a hobo, like walking around with all this crap. Yeah. And he just ripped into me like, where the fuck are you going to summer camp or something? You need your little pillow. You need your, you know, all this other shit. He just like in front of like a group of guys I've never met before in my life. Yeah. And he's just like ripping into me. And that it was like one of the funniest things.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's exactly what you said. Like he'll rip into you. You know, so much.
But I guarantee you, had anybody else said anything, Steve would have been the first person to be like, yo, shut the fuck up. That's my brother. Shut up.
Yeah, exactly. Yes. Yeah. He was totally like that. That was definitely him.
Yeah. So now that we've given a little background story on Steve, Steve was always a comedian. And so the day that Steve and Tristan got hit in Afghanistan. So we had actually planned this mission a number of times, to go and conduct. It was supposed to be done by an air assault. We were supposed to get airlifted into a high ground. We had gone into this village a couple of times, and every time we had gone in, we had had a firefight. We had had troops in contact, and, we had been lucky the first two times that we didn't get caught with our pants down. But the third time we went in, we did. And so it was supposed to be an air assault. We were supposed to get dropped off on the high point and basically do a hammer and anvil with two platoons, basically conducting this sweeping operation around this little, draw that was coming down off a mountain. And so plans change, goes from an air assault. We're going to drive in. Right. So this is the third time we've conducted an operation in this village and third time we've driven into the village. And so we take the same route in that we've taken every other time because it gives us a nice little bit of defilade to get into the village. There's a bit of open space that we had to cross. And so we threw smoke grenades. We threw shot some 203 smoke grenades to kind of give us a little bit of cover as we moved across, or concealment, I should say, not cover. Mm-hmm. And so we get up on this peninsula or this draw that we were supposed to get up on and be air assaulted onto. We finally get up on top. And so my platoon was conducting the sweep operation. So I was on the top. Actually, Steve and I were kind of in the middle of the top tier of the operation. Our lieutenant was at the very tip. Because he was kind of coordinating this whole like pendulum swing of his platoon. Jason Smith, my platoon sergeant, was down below coordinating the weapon. First and second squad, I think, was who was down there, and then third and weapons were up top. And so we're working with our ANA, Afghan National Army counterparts. And so we had literally just gotten up onto the draw. And we were taking a tactical pause because we were waiting for first and second squad to kind of catch up and swing around the draw because they were obviously fighting the terrain, but they were also fighting a couple of houses that were in their way. So they were having to clear the houses and go along. So we're taking a tactical pause. I'm on a knee, and all of a sudden I hear some shouting. It's in Farsi or Pashtun, and I hear – and then I hear ka-chunk, and I was like, fuck, what the fuck is that? And one of our ANA counterparts had actually walked up on somebody who was hiding in a ditch and went to engage him and basically had told him, like, drop your weapon, went to engage him, pulled his trigger, shot two rounds, and his weapon jammed. The guy who, the insurgent, stitched him with his AK-47. Pretty much right there. At which point the whole fucking hill exploded. And I remember trying to figure out where my guys were because the terrain was such that I couldn't see any of my guys from my squad. So I knew I had two guys in front of me that were right there. I just couldn't see them. And then all of a sudden I hear that Steven been hit. And so I got up and ran to find him because, you know, he was my best friend. And I crested a little, I don't even, like a drainage ditch. And I actually ran into Southworth and one of our guys, Mike Leonard. Southworth was the 240 Bravo machine gunner. And Southie just kind of pointed and said, he's over there, Sarge. He's hit. And so I ran up and I got to your brother. And, you know, I don't know if he was still alive, but I firmly believe that Steve died in my arms, man. You know, it's sorry.
I can imagine the
emotion
that, you know, going through not only then, but, you know, now even still, you know, kind of thinking back on it is got to be hard for anybody, really.
It's tough. But I got to him. I rolled him over. I basically held him for a minute. And then I realized that somebody was shooting at me or shooting at us. Mm-hmm. And, cause I could see puffs of dirt kicking up around me as I was holding Steve. And, I looked up and sure enough, there was two guys that were shooting at me from like 100 yards away. And, I picked up my rifle and I took care of business, and I immediately yelled up to the lieutenant that Steve was KIA. At which point, you know, it goes from a combat operation to a recovery operation to get our fallen angel out of there. So we continued to fight for a few more minutes. There was a little bit more confusion. The fight stopped for whatever reason. I think, you know, probably there was enough confusion that the initial unit that had kind of contacted us had kind of been disrupted. They didn't really know where we were. Because, again, you got to remember that the entire time, 1st and 2nd Platoon had been pivoting to sweep the lower part of the hill. So as more of my platoon was getting involved in the fight, I think the insurgents realized we may have bit off a little bit more than we could chew. So my Doc Mulcahy, our medic, comes flying up the fucking hill, man. Like, he had been down with 1st and 2nd Squad, and he did, man. He came flying up the fucking hill. Like, I have never seen anybody move up literally almost vertical terrain as fast as he did. Which is a credit to him, because he was, you know, rule number one for Doc doesn't let good men die. You know, rule number two, Doc will do everything he can to break rule number one, or prevent rule number one from happening. You know, he will fucking do anything he can to prevent rule number one from happening. And, mm-hmm. by the time Doc got there, obviously it was too late. But the funny thing about, you know, that moment that I remember vividly was at the beginning of the mission, when we got out of the trucks, Steve had jumped out of the truck and ripped his pants. And so he wasn't wearing underwear that day. And he turned and jokingly said, "Hey, Wes, do you want some bubble gum?" And he held it. And so I, of course, laughed. And when we were packaging Steve up to get him off of the hill, I happened to notice that his balls were hanging out of his pants. And I remember laughing, and the guys must have thought I was insane, because obviously it's this really tragic, horrible event. And I'm laughing, like, hysterically. And they're looking at me like, "What the fuck are you laughing at?" And I said, because he used to do it, like, he would walk up to people and pull his ball sack out and say, "Hey, you want some bubble gum?" And I just pointed down and I said, "You want some bubble gum?" And of course, everybody looks, sees Steve's balls hanging out. And of course, we all start laughing, because that was the way Steve was. And we all laughed at that.
He was.
That's exactly how Steve would have gone out. And so.
Yeah. I mean, even as a kid, you know, or growing up, you know, he was maybe, you know, a teenager or whatever, you know, just you know, we'd be, you know, hanging out at home or whatever, and he'd just like get up off the couch or get up, you know, go walk across the kitchen or whatever, and his ass would be hanging out. And we, you know, we look over, it's like, what are you doing? And so that doesn't surprise me like at all. Like, he did that, it didn't matter. And you know, he did other like stupid shit like that too, but you know, he would you know, you'd be telling him a story and it didn't quite interest him or whatever, or it was kind of a boring story to him, and he would just like, he'd be standing there and he would literally fall down to the ground and pretend like he was sleeping, like just collapse to the ground.
Yep,
and just,
I remember like, that
fall asleep.
Yeah, I remember that.
I mean, that does not surprise me at all that he would, you know, whip his balls out or whatever to just to, you know, get a laugh out of people, you know?
That was classic, man. So we get Steve packaged up, and we're actually starting to head down the hill to the LZ. We had called in the evacuation bird or called up to hire that we needed a medevac bird to get Steve out of there. And so as we're starting to come down the hill, we're on this kind of focal point of the draw, and it was really open and exposed. It wasn't a very good tactical place for us to kind of be walking, but it was the only clear path where we could have four guys carrying a poleless litter with our fallen angel. And so I was on Steve's left side. I was on the left side carrying, so it would have been Steve's right. And I was carrying his legs. And as we start to traverse down the hill, all of a sudden we get hit again with automatic machine gun fire, RPGs, like very accurate, very high volume fire. And so we all kind of hit the dirt, and you know, Steve gets dropped on the trail. And so like we all kind of scramble for cover and realize that Steve is still laying. So we all kind of get back up and bring him down into we all jumped into this little ditch, this drainage ditch that was next to the path. And so we're under extremely high volume fire, and I heard again that we had taken somebody who was wounded. Then I heard an RPG round impact, and I heard that somebody else was wounded, and I basically realized that we were sitting fucking ducks. And so I took it upon myself. I grabbed our two mortar guys that we had assigned to us. I ran down the hill. I set them up, and I started directing fire for them to engage this machine gun team that was firing at us from another ridge line almost like 500, 600 yards away. And they were doing an extremely good job of putting accurate fire on our position. And so these guys expend their mortar rounds. The machine gun goes quiet for a few minutes. I get up, I run back up the hill, and I told, I forget who I told, one of the guys that I was going to find us a house to basically collect all our casualties, because at this point I had heard that we had three more wounded. And so I heard three more wounded, but I think in total they had said that we had three wounded. And so I run down the hill, I find this house, and I grab two of my Joes as I'm going down, and we clear this fucking building. And it's a house, and we cleared it. There was a small family in it. There was mostly women and children. But anyway, we secure the place, and I run back up the hill to get like all of my guys to start moving down the hill to this position, so they're out of fire. And as they're coming down, as I'm like running up the hill, they're coming down. They had followed me down, and I grab this body and I start pulling it. And I thought it was Steve, and I was like, "Why is fucking Steve not in the litter?" And I realized that it wasn't Steve; it was Tristan Southward, and he had in the initial volley. He was he was our 240 gunner. In the initial volley, he had actually taken a round underneath his left armpit, and it had gone straight out through his right armpit and basically double lunged and heart the kid. And so he was dead on, you know, instantly. And Smitty had, he had been walking probably six men positioned behind me in the formation as we were moving out. Actually had an RPG explode like right in front of him, and the shrapnel actually came up and hit him in the face and knocked out most of his teeth. And so he has all this blood coming from his face. So we had some guys that performed really, really valorously that day. Specialist Brandon, who was one of my guys, actually took the 240 from Southwest Body and actually started engaging targets. And he won the Silver Star that day for his actions. Smitty won the Bronze Star with Valor because of the fact that he still maintained control over his platoon while wounded. Specialist Pilata, who actually wound up committing suicide a few years ago, after we got home, he won an ARCOM with Valor. He was one of the mortar guys that I had directed. Specialist Gubik, he won an ARCOM with Valor. He was another one of the mortar guys. I received the Bronze Star. Doc actually received the Bronze Star with Valor for treating patients under fire, mainly Smitty, and a couple other guys won some awards for their bravery and heroism. And at the end of the day, when we finally kind of totaled up and our losses, and we got down into the house, we realized that we had two fallen angels and a couple of knocked up or knocked around angels. So we had some pretty serious wounds to lick that day. Mm-hmm. And you know, at the end of the day, we kind of expected to be taken out of the village, to be medevaced out. Or, well, not medevaced out, but like, you know, evacuated out. We were kind of expecting to get pulled out of the village that night, and they actually wound up keeping us in the fucking village on the main road in our fucking trucks overnight. Because, yeah, so we had to spend the night in the fucking village that we just lost two fucking guys, sleeping on the main road in our fucking truck, because when we were starting to consolidate the company back down, it was like 6:30 at night, and higher command, like battalion level command, decided that it was too late for us to move, and that they couldn't get air assets to get the quick reaction force platoon out, so they didn't want us to leave the quick reaction force on the ground by themselves. So our entire company had to stay to basically overwatch the acting battalion commander, because the real battalion commander was on leave. The acting battalion commander was a Major Langevin, and the quick reaction force platoon had to stay and basically safeguard them until the next day when they could get air assets in to get us out.
Right.
Yeah, that was a rough 24 hours. So.
Yeah, I could only imagine, you know, how all that went down, you know, it being in there. I know when I, that day I was out on a mission too. And we basically like flew in, we had helicopters land on top of a mountain outside of a village. And we kind of worked our way down the village and we were going through clearing it. And, at one point during our mission, Blackhawk comes in and kind of lands like at the bottom of the hill outside of the village, and like a U.S. general, I forget how many stars, but I know he was a general, came off the bird, and a couple French soldiers as well came off, and they were kind of like walking around, and they came over to us and they were talking to us, and something came over the radio to one of the people. I think it was to the general who was there, and he had said that they had just lost you know, two soldiers earlier that day, and he was in a weird way he was talking to me about it, and me, I was you know, sergeant, you know, nothing. I was there, but I didn't really, you know, have any sort of importance. It just happened to be I was the guy he was talking to, and so he was telling me about that, but he had no idea who I was. He had no idea who was killed or anything. And so later that day, after I got the news about Steven and everything, they called for Blackhawks to come take me and a couple of guys who were wounded that day, take them off the mountain once when we were kind of wrapping up with everything. And the Blackhawk, I ended up getting on that same general who had talked to me earlier that day was sitting like right across from me. And he looked at me, he goes, didn't I talk to you? Like you seem fine. Like what's going on? I was like, yeah, my brother was KIA. And he goes, that was your brother. And we just talked, a couple hours earlier. And it was like such a strange coincidence.
Yeah.
That, it was the same person who talked to me earlier that day. And he had no idea who I was or who Steven was or anything like that. But, it was bizarre.
Yeah. Yeah. And I've heard, I don't identify as a particularly religious man. I believe in a higher power. I don't go to church every Sunday. Mm-hmm. I don't follow an organized religion, but I do believe that there is something good after, all of this. There has to be, because I've seen so much horrible fucking shit for there not to be something on the other end. And, it's funny, 'cause like, you gotta know that it's, I firmly believe that was Steve's way of kind of bracing you for the news that was to come.
I've reflected on that quite a bit over the years and thought to myself, like, why did things work out the way they did? And, kind of like you said, it's like, I sort of feel like, everything happens for a reason. Yeah. And that, like, I don't believe that was a coincidence that guy was there and that he specifically talked to me, about that type of stuff. Kind of soften the blow a little bit, because in the back of your head, you sort of have to think, it could have been, but even though that wasn't necessarily the thought that I had, that it was Steve necessarily, because out of the thousands of other soldiers, who would have thought it would necessarily been him, but, it sort of softened it a little bit. But I even remember after, I got to Bagram, after all that happened, and like everybody there was like totally taking care of like everything for me. Like they were, trying to make sure everything was okay for me. And I was all like torn up and everything from the mission that we were on, uniform and everything like that. So I looked like hell, but they told me to go take a shower and everything. And I remember standing there in the shower, and it was just me in this particular room. And I remember just verbally going like, why, like, I don't know if I was talking to God at that moment or if I was talking to Steve, like, why you, or, whatever. But in the moment, I kind of realized that these things happen for a reason, and that, I may not understand that reason. The situation might suck, but everything I felt like happens for a reason. I kind of just have to trust it and go with it. No amount of questioning it is going to change it.
Yeah.
So, you kind of have to,
and that's kind of the attitude that we had to take. We were, as a platoon, we're fucking devastated. I mean, it took us a good solid month to finally get back to being even a semi-functional fucking unit. Yep. I mean, I say that, but it probably was only a couple of weeks before we were back on doing missions, but we weren't the same. I think everybody kind of got that realization that, we are very, very, very fucking mortal. We had been extremely lucky our entire deployment that no one had really gotten hurt or no one had really gotten injured. Certainly no one had gotten killed before August 22nd. And so, we had quite a bit of confidence that had built up, because we thought, for lack of a better term, we were fucking invincible, man. And then mm-hmm. for us to have that super devastating blow come, it really knocked quite a few of us on our ass. Me especially, because Charles Ames, Chuck Ames, Steve and I were best friends, and you know, it was a very, very hard blow for Chuck and I, because we were, you know, we were the three of fucking amigos, man. That was who we were. And right. So, you know, even today, like, Chuck and I, you know, we talk, but it's, you know, you can tell that there is a very big hole in not our relationship. I don't want to say that, but like, you can tell that there is a very big space because of the pain that the two of us feel for losing our friend. I mean, I can only imagine how much it is for you and your family losing your brother and your son. But I mean, it's funny, because everybody in combat understands how we are brothers and we become family. Like, you know, you take people from all different walks of life and you literally throw them into this melting pot, this crucible pot, and you turn them out into a family of people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, to lose not just one, but two brothers in a day, it did a wonderful job bonding the rest of us, but it did an amazing job of smashing a lot of us. And it was right. Really, really hard to recover from. And some of us still haven't recovered. You know, and that's part of the message here, is that you've got to, you know, no matter what life throws at you in terms of blows, you know, life is going to hit you in the teeth multiple times. That's when you got to, you know, you lay on the ground for a second, you catch your breath, you spit your blood and teeth out, and then you got to roll back over and get on your hands and knees, and you got to find that strength to put that foot forward and just stand back up. And I've had to learn from not just Steve's death, but from my friends in Iraq who were killed. You know, Mark Dooley, who was my platoon leader, who got killed actually in my truck spot 5 days after I got wounded. He was in the spot that I was in because I had gotten wounded 5 days before. That was the first time I ever got knocked on my fucking ass. And, you know, it was really, really hard to pick myself back up, because the night before he had spent time with me sitting in a truck smoking a cigar and gave me his Ranger tab because I had wanted to go to Ranger school. And literally the night before, man, he got fucking killed in my spot. He gave me his fucking Ranger tab and told me to put it in my hat when I went to Ranger school and look at it. And I still have that Ranger tab. It's downstairs and all my stuff. And, you know, I'm in the process of renovating my basement and building a bar. And someday when my bar is done, I'm going to hang that very proudly next to all the other military memorabilia and pictures that I have of all my friends. But
yeah, absolutely.
So, but I do have now that we've kind of talked and been somber, I do have a very funny story about Steve. So a couple months ago, do you remember the church that your parents grew up in? They were Eucharist ministers down in Glastonbury.
Yeah. Okay.
What was the name of that church?
St. Dunstan's.
Okay. So my aunt, who married into my family, so my uncle Neil, my mother's brother, his wife had a family member pass away. I think it was her brother. And he had been a member of the local Glastonbury community for a long time. He was a member of like Glastonbury, Connecticut, country club, like the, I don't know, whatever the country club is there. And so my wife and I and my son went down to support her for the funeral, right? So I'm in the church and I'm sitting in the back and I'm looking around and I'm like, wow, this is a really nice church, a really beautiful church. And of course I see my cousins, I see my aunt and my uncle, and I'm waving hi, and my kid starts getting kind of fussy because, you know, three-year-olds don't like to sit still and sit quiet. And so
sure.
My wife gets up and she walks out and takes him into the lobby, and I'm sitting there. And the next thing I know, I feel this tap on my shoulder, and I kind of turn and I look, and it's my wife, and she's holding my son, and she hands me Stephen's memorial card from his funeral 9 years after the fact. right? Of course, I have at the time, I have no idea that this is the church that you and Steve and your parents like grew up in and were Eucharistic ministers in. And so I'm like fucking flat out shocked, right? Like all the fucking churches in all the fucking county of Glastonbury, Connecticut, I find the one that has a picture of Steve in it, right? And so my wife had actually walked out, and as she was walking out, she looked up and she saw Steve's picture, and she goes, "Oh, hi, Steve." And so she pulled the picture down, brought it into me, and of course I start like fucking giggling, laughing, right? Because I'm like, "You motherfucker, like, of course." And so we walk out of the church service, and I walk up to my aunt, my uncle, and my cousins, and Laura is telling them the story of how she found the prayer card. And of course my aunt is like wicked superstitious, and she's like, "Oh my God, it's a sign." And so I start, I'm kind of laughing, and I'm like, "All right, yeah, it's a sign. Yeah, I know." And so we went to the country club for the luncheon after the funeral, right? And so I'm sitting there, and I was in a really nice suit. It was an older suit, like one of the first kind of suits that I had bought. And so Ronan, my son, gets up and starts running from one end of the country club, like banquet hall, to the other. And so I, of course, have to run after him, right? Because he's taken off running towards the front door. And so just as I catch Ronan, I go to step and block him, and the seat of my pants split wide open. Right? Only Wes Black at a fucking funeral banquet splits the seam of his pants wide open. And of course, I'm not wearing underwear. And what do you think? What do you think is hanging out of the bottom of my fucking pants?
Want some bubble gum?
And so I literally start laughing. Because I can't do anything else, right? I'm holding my kid, trying to like pull my pants together so you don't see my ass. And I walk back in, and my wife's like, "You all right?" And I'm like, "No, my fucking pants just split." And she goes, "What?" And so I hand Ronan to her, and I'm like, "I gotta go get my jacket," because it was probably February or March. It was cold. And so I go get my fancy dress jacket, and I literally tie it around my waist like a sweatshirt, and my aunt is like, "Oh my God." So I tell my uncle the story of Steve when he died and how he had his bubble gum out. And my uncle starts fucking howling laughing. And he goes, "You gotta be shitting me." And I'm like, "Nope." And he goes, "And you?" And I was like, "Yup." And he goes, "Motherfucker, if that isn't a fucking sign, I don't know what is." And so I actually went to visit Steve not long after the funeral service, because I had planned on, because we were literally like 10 minutes away from Steve's headstone. And so I swing in to see Steve, and I kneel over his grave, and I'm like, "You motherfucker." And so I introduced Steve to Rona for the first time. But I'll tell you, man, I couldn't stop laughing, and I called your dad actually that night to tell him the story. And even he was laughing his ass off, going, "Oh, it's too classic. Like, there's no way it wasn't Steve." And he goes, "And I bet you Steve, even if it wasn't him, was dying laughing, like laughing his ass off."
Oh, sure. Yeah, exactly. And it's funny because that the Glastonbury Country Club where you said you were at is the same place that we had the same banquet kind of reception after Steve's funeral. Yeah. And that's where we had we did a golf tournament for the first few years after he passed away to kind of like raise some money for charity stuff.
First year I came was I think the year before you guys stopped doing it, because you guys had moved out to Arizona.
Yeah. So yeah, we did it there. We did all I think we did it 5 years afterwards, and so all 5 years did at the Glastonbury Country Club there.
Okay.
And as growing up as kids, we played golf there, and everything. So it like that was a kind of part of our lives too. And so it's funny how it continues to have Steve's presence even to this day. With the your pants ripping.
Well, it's funny, man, because you know, the only reason I ever picked up the game of golf, and actually I've actually become, I don't want to say a good golfer, a decent, an okay golfer. I don't have fantastic handicap. I have a 15 handicap, but I've only been playing for a few years, and the only reason I picked up golf clubs was because I wanted to play in Steve's tournament, and I started playing. I do think it was the second year, or the year before you guys, your parents and you guys had moved out to Arizona, because you were hitting balls on one of the tees for like $10 or something. Like you hit a golf drive for people I remember playing, because I played with Gene Enriquez and Mark Slade, because we had all gone down to play. So, but yeah, that was, so that's the only reason why I play golf now, is to be able to get to heaven and kick your brother's ass at fucking golf.
Well, we've stopped doing the golf tournament. It got to be quite a bit of work to put on an event of that size. And especially, you know, now that we're all living out here, it's kind of hard to do that type of thing remotely. But we are actually planning a more of just like a banquet, kind of like a dinner type thing at the weekend after Memorial Day, I think May 30th of this coming year, 2020, in Connecticut. We're all going back for that. And so, you guys and, we're looking forward to having that. So, if anybody who's available to come down, who wants to kind of join us or whatever, we'll have more information coming out in the next, few weeks.
I tell you right now, man, I guarantee you 90% of my platoon will show up for it. Yeah, we would have a bunch of dudes ready to show up and go to that. I guarantee it.
Great. All right. This has been, amazing, to kind of, chat with you about everything and kind of, share some memories about Steve and everything. And I think that's kind of a fitting way to, kind of mark the anniversary, 9 years now, that since his passing. And, so thank you for, coming on and sharing, your thoughts and your memories, about all of this stuff. Thanks for coming on.
I'm really happy I got to come on, man. I thank you for giving me opportunity to talk about Steve I hope that whoever's listening to this, if you're a veteran and you feel like you literally have run out of any options, I read a really good, I don't know if it's a comment or like a picture meme on Facebook the other day, but it was, I would rather sit and listen for 4.5 hours for you to get out everything that you need to get out and talk about and make you feel better than spend 15 minutes listening to your eulogy. And, that there isn't a fucking truer statement. I don't think about any veteran would be willing to, do anything for another vet. So if you are, if you're a veteran listening to this, or even if you're not a veteran listening to this and you're going through some sort of, mental health crisis, reach out to somebody. There's always somebody willing to listen. Because I tell you, I really would. I'd rather spend 12 hours on the phone with you, walking you through something that's going on, than sit and listen to your eulogy for 15 minutes. So,
absolutely. And I think, I don't know really anybody who would disagree with that kind of sentiment.
Well, and you told me right before we started the show that you've had members of your unit that have committed suicide, and we've had two from our unit and one from a sister unit that have committed suicide since returning home from Afghanistan. And it's 22 a day is what they say the average is for veterans committing suicide. Mm-hmm. And that's too many. That's, one is too many, but 22 is definitely way too many. So,
sure.
You know, I would like to say that if anybody needs it, reach out. There's tons of options for reach out to a battle buddy. You know, if somebody that is listening to this that knows me, reach out to me. You know, if you're listening to this, you obviously know Scott, reach out to Scott. You know, please do not make a permanent solution for a temporary problem.
Absolutely. I don't think truer words have been spoken on this show. That definitely needs to get across. And I think that's, you know, kind of part of why I'm doing this is I can't stand seeing, you know, people make those, you know, permanent decisions and not have any way, you know, to get out of them.
And I don't mean to, you know, toot my own horn. That's not why I'm on here. But if I can go through everything that I'm going through, you know, the post-traumatic stress, the TBI, the, you know, the fact that I've been handed this terminal diagnosis, you know, some of the shit that I've seen on the fire side, some of the shit that I've seen on the military side, if I can find the strength every morning to get up and put my two fucking feet on the floor, guess what? You can too. And I don't care who is listening to this. If I can do it, so can you. And you need to be able to do it every single day. It may be fucking the hardest thing you do, but you need to put your two feet on the floor.
So. Absolutely. Amen to that. So, all right, well, let's kind of wrap it up, and thank you again for joining me, and
thank you, Scott,
and for everything else that's been going on.
Yeah,
so
thank you, man.
Thanks for listening to the Drive On Podcast. If you want to check out more episodes or learn more about the show, you can visit our website, driveonpodcast.com. We're on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at Drive On Podcast.